Welcome to the Hand Tools and Techniques Woodworking Podcast. I'm your host, Bob Rosieski, answering your questions and bringing you tips and tricks to help you get the most out of your time in the shop. Are you having problems edge jointing your boards dead straight? Do the boards you plane flat just cup again a few minutes later? Have you ever wanted to try building your own handsaw? I'll discuss these topics and more today on Hand Tools and Techniques. Hey everyone, welcome back to Hand Tools and Techniques. Thanks for joining me for episode 18 of the show for January 24th, 2018. Before I start today's show, I just want to take a minute to thank all the folks who support the show over on Patreon, including Bill Elliott, Arcadius Jakowski, Bill Warnock, Chris Turkay, Lawrence Polinski, Jeff Skiles, Joe Delorier, Jens Rosendahl, Matt McGrain, Jared Tolan, Chris Barnes, Christopher Bush, Lance Stutchel, and thanks to a new patron this week, John Schuster. Thank you everyone for your generous support of the show. And if you'd like to support the show, just head on over to patreon.com/brfinewoodworking. And if you pledge $3 a month or more, you'll get access to a once a month patron-only episode of the podcast as my special way of saying thanks. So not a whole lot going on in the shop this week. It was kind of nice for a few days. We got a nice break in the winter weather. We had some weather in almost actually just into the low 60s for a couple of days. And I actually got to get out and finish up a saw I was working on for a customer so he can come pick that up this coming weekend. And so I got that done. But now we're back into the 20s again, and it's cold, and it's quite windy tonight. So if you hear some rattling during the show, it's just the roll-up door on my shop rattling in the wind because we've got quite a bit of wind here tonight. So other than that, just been working on the cabin, trying to get that done. We're all closed in, and I think I mentioned the inspections that we got that passed. So we're at the point now where I'm going to be building a staircase. So playing with power tools that I haven't really messed with in a while. So lots of router work I think I'm going to be doing this weekend. So we'll see what happens and how that goes. So our first question tonight comes from Devin Sands, and Devin sent in a voice memo. Let's listen to that.
Hey Bob, this is Devin from Spokane, Washington. I'm currently making a walnut tabletop. When I'm edge joining the edges with my number 7 jointer, there's one joint that doesn't fit together, making it look like there's a bow in the edge. All the other joints match flawlessly, but I can't get the gap to close on this one joint. I'm getting full length, full width shavings down the whole length of the board on the lightest setting, and again, only on this one joint. Has a gap, making it look like the joint isn't straight. Do you know what might be going on and how to fix it? And as a side note, thanks for hosting a podcast that's all about hand tools. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
So thanks for your question, Devin, and special thanks for sending it in via a voice memo, because I get tired of talking. It's nice to hear you guys talk once in a while. So I can think of a few things that might be going on here. You didn't mention whether or not you glued up the other boards already. So the first thing I'm thinking is if you're making a panel out of several boards and you're jointing and gluing one joint at a time, what could be happening is that after you glued up the first set of boards or the first three boards or however many you're using, that clamping pressure, if those joints weren't all perfectly straight, the clamping pressure could put just enough bow in the board that it's causing, once the glue dries and you take the clamps off, it's holding a very, very, very slight bow in that board. Keep in mind, the human eye can see, if you put two boards together and you see light, that light could be less than a thousandth of an inch, that gap. The human eye is capable of detecting a very, very small amount of light coming through those boards. So if that's what you're looking at, it could just be that, when you glued up the previous boards, you clamped in a small amount of bow into the edge of the panel. And now when you're, even though you put those two boards together and they joined seamlessly before, now they're not. So you would have to rejoin the panel and then, make that match up to your last board. The other thing that could be happening is if the boards moved after you planed them, which is certainly possible. So you may have planed them straight at one point, and then if you let them sit overnight and you go to do the other one the next day, that first one could have moved. So it may not be perfectly straight anymore. I find when I'm going to do an edge joint, I really like to do the planing and the gluing all in one shot. So plane them, glue them, clamp them, and get it done before those boards have a chance to move. So that's another thing that could be happening. The third thing that could be happening, you mentioned you're getting full length shavings, but that doesn't necessarily mean the board is straight. That board could actually have a slight hump in it. And that will give you full length shavings. I don't know if that's what's happening in your case. What I would suggest you do, there's two ways that I would suggest you can fix this problem. The first is to make sure you have yourself a good straight edge, whether it's a, like a good 3 foot steel rule or a wooden straight edge that you've made yourself and tested so that you know that it's straight. And check the edge of both of those boards and see which one is not straight, because if they're joining up with a gap between them, at least one of those boards is not straight, possibly both of them. If you don't have a good straight edge, the other thing you can use the edge of your joiner plane. That should be relatively straight, so you can use that kind of as a straight edge, and you just use the corner and kind of tip it over and check those two boards to see if one of them's not straight, if you're seeing some light between the plane and the board itself. If you're having problems getting both of those edges dead straight, you can amplify the problem by match planing them. So if you plane the two together at the same time, clamp them the two edges together, and plane start in the middle and plane them both hollow, and then go ahead and do your jointing from edge to edge after you've planed that hollow in the middle, so that you're getting a broken shaving. You're getting a short shaving at the beginning of the stroke and a short shaving at the end of the stroke. And as you make passes, that shaving will get progressively longer until you have one solid shaving. Once you get one solid shaving, stop, because if you keep going, then you're going to make the edges bowed. Put the two boards together and check them and see if the joint closes up. If it doesn't, you may have to clamp them together and make one more pass or two more passes. Just to make sure, and you're going to want to make sure you clamp them back together nice and flush and level. And that match planing will help because you won't have to worry about them being totally dead square either. And I'll put a link to a video that I did about match planing years ago, and you can kind of get an idea there. But I would say check with a straight edge and see, because what it sounds to me is that either one of your boards moved after you planed it and it's not totally straight, or maybe you got full length shavings, but the board is kind of bowed, so you think it's straight, but it's not. So I would say definitely check it with a straight edge and see which one is out of flat, because one of those mating pair is definitely not straight, and that's what's causing you the problem. So you're going to need to fix the one that's not straight. So our next question comes from Bill Elliott. He says, "I'm making a new workbench and have decided on a Nicholson style with a tool tray. I'm trying to decide on the width of the entire bench and the width for the bench top and the tool tray. For example, if a 24-inch total width, then is there a strategy on size of the tool tray? I keep changing my mind about a 12-inch bench and a 12-inch tray versus 14-10 or 16-8. I cannot anticipate how wide of a bench top workspace I really need. Is 12 inches enough?" So I'll preface this by saying, no matter how wide your bench top is, it's never going to be wide enough. You're always going to find a situation where it's not wide enough. But with that said, in terms of total width of a workbench, I would caution you not to make it too wide. I find that at 24, 26 inches or so is about as wide as I am comfortable working at a bench, for a couple of reasons. If you put that bench against a wall, you want to be able to reach across it and get to anything that's on the wall on the other side of the bench. Once you start to get over 24, 26, 27 inches deep, most people will have a hard time reaching across that. There's a reason kitchen countertops are usually only 24 inches deep, and that's so that you can comfortably reach across without having to stretch. When upwards of 30 inches and you're really going to start to feel like you're really having to reach across to get to the other side of the bench. If you're not going to put your bench against the wall, maybe that's not such a big deal because you can walk around to the other side. But you're going to find that there is a point of diminishing returns where going wider really doesn't help you much. I would say probably no wider than 30 inches, and I wouldn't go any wider than, about 26 or so if you're going to put the bench against a wall. In terms of a tool tray, my opinion of tool trays, I'll tell you, I really don't like them. What I've found in my experience is that they just collect a lot of junk. Tools get lost in there, then they fill up with shavings and you lose your tools. And even if the tools don't get dumped into the tray, they fill up with shavings and they're a pain to clean out. And then you get a wide case piece or something that you're assembling on top of the workbench and it's too wide for the main part of the workbench and it wants to tip into the tool well. And so I'm not a big fan of tool wells. If you have a separate assembly table, I would think you can, you could do okay with a bench with a tool well. But if you're not going to have a separate assembly table, I would actually recommend that you skip the tool well because really they end up just collecting junk. I had a bench with one on it. I've worked on other benches that have them and I just don't care for them. But in terms of how wide the tool well should be, most of them are really only about 6 to 8 inches wide. They're really not all that wide. I would definitely not go more than a third of the width of the bench top. You're going to want that bench space. I would say 12 inches is probably not enough. If you have to plane a panel, that panel might be 18 or 24 inches wide, and you're going to want some support for that. So I would say if you're going to add a tool well to the bench, don't go any more than about a third of the width of the bench. So if it's a 24 inch wide bench top, I would say keep the main bench at least 16 inches and don't make that tool well any wider than about 8 inches. And I think what you're going to find is you don't even really need it that wide because for the most part, you're only going to have a few tools and most tools can fit into a tool well that's about 6 inches wide. And the wider that tool well is, the more junk it's going to get cluttered up with anyway. So I would keep it, no more than 6 to 8 inches wide. So our next question comes from Alex Young. It says, I'm building a pine tool chest. And after I flatten the wood, within a few minutes, it is cupped again. I was told by the sawmill that the wood is kiln dried to 8 to 10%, though I do not have a moisture meter to verify this. In order to remove the concavity from the inside and convex surface from the bark side, the board goes from 4/4 to 3/4 or 5/8. I haven't experienced this recupping in other woods, but it is making this project much more difficult than it needs to be. Is there something I'm doing incorrectly, or is it something to do with the pine? Prior to working the wood, I did let it sit in my workshop for around 2 to 3 weeks to acclimate. I keep the workshop at around 50 to 55 degrees. So, Alex, I think the problem is likely the wood, not because it's pine. Believe it or not, pine is actually one of the more stable woods that you can find. The bad rap that pine gets is because most of the pine that we get or that you find is in construction lumber. And most of that is dried, only to the high teens in terms of being kiln dried, if it's kiln dried at all, which means there's still quite a bit of moisture in that wood. And then as it dries, further, it tends to warp and cup. In addition to that, narrower pine boards are taken from, any narrower boards are typically going to be taken from smaller trees. And those trees are going to tend to have a little bit more reaction wood in them, and they tend to cut more and bow more. What I think is happening with your boards is if they were in fact dried to 8 to 10%, and then you let them acclimate in your shop, my guess is that they probably just have a lot of reaction wood in them. The tree may not have grown straight. It might have grown on a hillside or, strong winds in an area with strong winds. And trees that grow in these types of areas can develop reaction, what we call reaction wood. And what that means is that there's tension on one side of the tree. So one side of the tree might be compressed and the other side might be stretched. And no matter how you cut that board, how you plane that board, it's going to react because every time you do something to that board, you're releasing some of that tension and it's going to react because of that. Sometimes we just get these boards that no matter what we try to do with them, they don't want to cooperate and there's nothing that we can do. I do feel for you. It has happened to me before where I've planed boards and they cupped immediately or they bowed immediately after ripping them. It does happen from time to time. What I would say to avoid it in the future is to make sure that you're buying from a reputable lumberyard that has, you know, does good business, good repeat business, that they do dry their own lumber is probably a good idea because then they're going to be making sure that, you know, they've got a good drying schedule, kiln schedule worked out, that their boards aren't going crazy on them. But you know, it doesn't matter. Sometimes it's just going to happen. You're just going to run into those situations where you get a board with some reaction wood and that's what happens. It is common in pine construction lumber. I found that in good kiln dried white pine, it doesn't happen as often. If it's sawn well, if it's a wider board and if it is truly kiln dried to a good low moisture content, it doesn't typically happen with white pine, again, unless you happen to have some boards that just have a lot of reaction wood in them, in which case there's not a whole lot you can do but cut those boards up into smaller pieces. If you have to use them for your tool chest, if these are going to be the wide sides, the panels of the main chest itself, I would say you're going to want to get the joinery for that cut into those boards as quickly as you can. I would plane them to 4/4. You mentioned 3/4 or 5/8. So I'm imagining you're using these for something else besides the main case, because the main case 5/8 of an inch is a little bit thin for the main case, even 3/4, you know, if it's a full size tool chest. But I would say, you know, cut the joinery as soon as you can afterwards. So rather than planing all of your stock in one shot, plane the stock flat and cut the joinery right away. If it's cupping that fast that you can't even finish planing it before it stops, what you can do is to clamp the cup out. I have done this with wide pieces before where I have not been able to get to cut the joinery right away, where I will use the straight front edge of my workbench, and instead of clamping in a vise, I'll take a good stiff board and use it as a call and use a couple of Bessie clamps or pipe clamps or something like that and actually clamp the cup out of that board flat against the front of my workbench. Cut the joinery with the board clamped flat and then go ahead and transfer the joinery from, you know, if you're cutting dovetails, from one board to the other, again, with that board clamped flat. And then what'll happen is when you go to assemble that, you may need a little bit extra clamping pressure to do so. But once you assemble it, if you cut the joinery with the board flat and then you kind of force it back into flat when you assemble it and put some good clamping pressure on it, you should be able to get it to stay fairly flat. But you do need the board to be flat when you make the joinery. So like I said, in order to do that, just clamp the cup out before you cut the joinery and you should be okay. So our last question this week comes from John Bates. John says, I'm interested in building a dovetail saw. I'd like to keep the cost to a minimum as I'm not sure how it will turn out, so I'd like to avoid any specialized tools. I plan to use a drywall taping knife for the blade. Can you give your thoughts on shop-built saw vices and hammer-setting teeth? For a dovetail saw, what rake angle do you recommend? Do you recommend any fleam on the teeth? So the first saw that I ever built, I built with a drywall taping knife, and I will say that it certainly works. You'll have to sharpen it a little bit more often than you will with a like a 1095 spring steel blade, which has a higher carbon content and will therefore hold an edge longer. But at the same time, the files are going to cut the steel much easier than 1095. So and with the cheap files we seem to be getting these days that are kind of soft and don't seem to last very long, you should actually be able to get a file to last quite a bit longer with the drywall taping knife steel than you will be with 1095. So nothing wrong with that. It'll work just fine. You probably just have to sharpen it a little bit more often. Shop built saw vices. I had several of them. My second saw vise, I should say, was shop built. And they work just fine. I mean, I've sharpened saws with nothing more than a pair of pine sticks. If you take two pine 1x2s and put them on either side of the saw blade and put that whole assembly in your bench vise, you can sharpen a saw that way. You don't need any kind of specialized saw vise. They're nice. Actual saw vices will help dampen vibration a little bit better. They seem to clamp a little bit stronger than the old wooden ones, or the pair of sticks in the bench vise. But again, they'll work just fine. I've done it at woodworking shows. I've demonstrated saw sharpening with nothing more than, like I said, a pair of 1x2s and a bench vise. And I've taught classes where that's what we've used as well, because the wooden saw vices that I had couldn't clamp into the vices that were on the benches. So we had to improvise. So you don't need a whole lot in terms of a saw vise. In terms of setting, hammer setting takes quite a bit of skill and finesse to do. The problem isn't that it's hard to set the teeth with a hammer. It's hard to set them consistently. So if there is one tool that I recommend that you do buy, it would be a saw set. But I understand if you're really trying to do this on a real shoestring budget and you don't want to spend the money on a saw set, you want to try and set the teeth with a hammer and a nail set, you can certainly do that. What I would recommend is to lay the saw flat on a piece of softwood. White pine works good, balsa, something that will dent slightly. But you don't want to go crazy, because you can overset the teeth, and it's very easy to do with hammer setting. And you're going to use a very small nail set or punch or of some kind, and just let the weight of the hammer do the setting. I wouldn't plane any kind of bevel into the board that you're going to use to set the saw against. Just let the softness of the wood itself, give you how much room you need for the teeth. You're going to find that it's very hard to set consistently with a hammer until you get the hang of it. So what I would suggest is that after you set the teeth with a hammer, take a piece of paper, take a piece of printer paper from your office or wherever, notebook paper, whatever you've got, fold it over the teeth of the saw, and then take that saw and clamp it in a vise with metal jaws, like a machinist vise, and just squeeze on the teeth through the paper. And what's going to happen is that will help to even the set out a little bit. The paper is going to act as sort of a shim. And what it will do is as the vise bends the teeth back and essentially unsets them, the paper that you have draped over the teeth will only let the vise press so far, and it acts as sort of a spacer. So, and that'll help you to even out the set a little bit, because like I said, you're not going to get real great even set setting with a hammer if you don't really have a whole lot of experience doing it. In terms of rake angle, I file my dovetail saws somewhere between 0 and 4 degrees. The teeth are small and they're meant for ripping. So, a low rake angle is what I find best. I don't use fleam on my dovetail saws. Even if I want to cross cut with it once in a while, the teeth are so small. I think my dovetail saw is 17 teeth per inch or points per inch. So the teeth are so small that I don't really find fleam necessary for the minimal amount of cross-cutting that I do with my dovetail saw. And like I said, most of the cross-cutting that I do with other saws anyway. My dovetail saw really is primarily used for sawing out the rip cuts for a dovetail. So I don't use any fleam at all. So I hope that helps, and good luck building your saw. So that's all for the mailbox for this week. As always, if you have feedback, questions, or topic suggestions for the show, you can record a voice memo on your phone and email it to bob@brfinewoodworking.com. You can leave a voicemail at 276-601-3123, or you can also go to brfinewoodworking.com/contact and fill out the contact form. So today's main topic is should be an interesting one for those of you who enjoy some of the historical aspects of the craft, because I want to touch a bit on history today. But I think the topic's also very relevant for new woodworkers who don't feel up to the task of cutting the hardcore joinery like the dovetails and the mortise and tenons, or for folks who just need to get something solid and functional built quickly without a lot of fuss. So I'm going to use the brief history lesson as kind of a segue, and we're also going to talk about using nails in furniture. So nails get kind of a bad rap these days, and I think they're starting to make a comeback, and people are starting to become a little bit more accepting of nails now. But you know, it's taken a while, and it's taken a lot of work on the part of folks like, you know, Christopher Schwarz and Adam Carabini and myself and Peter Follinsby and folks who study this kind of stuff to kind of bring, you know, nails and things like that back into light. You know, one of the interesting accounts that I read has to do with carpenters and joiners in London back in the 1600s. And this report has been mentioned before by several folks. And the museum that I used to volunteer at, we used to talk about it quite a bit with the visitors, because it's kind of a good segue and introduction into some of the work that we see during the period. So what I want to talk about is it's a 1632 historical account of the Worshipful Company of Carpenters in London, England. And it, essentially what happened was in 1632, there was a committee formally appointed to hear the differences between the company, the Worshipful Company of Carpenters and the Worshipful Company of Joiners in London. And there was this argument going on between the carpenters and the joiners about what work each of those two guilds can do. And if you know anything about guilds from the past, they could actually get pretty violent, you know, if they thought someone was stealing their work or work that they should be doing. You know, things could get kind of nasty. You know, they make today's labor unions, you know, look like book clubs. So. But in essence, you had this disagreement between the joiners and the carpenters. And, you know, at the time, joiners and carpenters were two completely separate trades. Today, we look at anyone who does some kind of woodwork. A lot of people will just call them a carpenter, whether they're a framer or a roofer or a finished carpenter. They all just kind of get lumped into carpenters. Well, in the 1630s, the carpenters did part of the work, and the joiners did a different part of the work. Primarily, the carpenters did what we would refer to today as your framing. They did the heavy timber work, cutting the mortise and tenons and the dovetails in the timber frame structures. The joiners were the ones that came along and did the finish work. They would take care of putting siding on. They would take care of doing flooring, wainscoting, staircases, making the windows and doors and hanging the windows and doors and things of that nature. But there was also the issue of furniture. You know, carpentry and building houses is kind of seasonal work. So in the off season, the carpenters and the joiners look for other things to do. And most of the time, you know, that could be building furniture. But there's a disagreement between the carpenters and the joiners about who can do what types of work. So in 1632, the committee did deliver into this court a report in writing. And it went to court, and they delivered a report. And essentially, it spelled out what the joiners were allowed to do and what the carpenters were allowed to do. And it's interesting when you read through the list, and I'm not going to go through everything, but when I'll read through a few of the items, and you'll start to see a common theme. So if you look at the work that is properly belonging to the joiners, all sorts of bedsteads whatsoever, except boarded bedsteads that are nailed together, all sorts of chairs and stools which are made with mortise and tenons, wainscot, walnut wainscot, or other stuff glued with frames, mortises, and tenons. All sorts of forms framed made of boards with these sides pinned or glued. Chests framed with dovetails pinned and glued. Cabinets or boxes dovetailed, pinned, glued, or joined. Cupboards framed, dovetailed, pinned, or glued. Presses for clothing. Wainscoting. Shop windows, doors. And the list continues to go on for the joiners. So let's talk about, let's go through a few of the things that the carpenters were allowed to do. So let's see. They're allowed to do tables. Tables for taverns, and other tables made of deal, elm, oak, or beech, or other wood nailed together without glue, except all sorts of tables nailed, framed, or glued being movable. Stools, washing stools, bucking stools, and other stools whatsoever that are to be headed with oak, elm, beech, or deal, and footed with square or round feet, except all frame stools glued or pinned. Let's see, what else? All sorts of forms made of elm, oak, beech, or deal to be nailed so that they, and then not have turned feet. And a form is essentially a bench. If you know what a joint stool is, Peter Follansbee and Jenny Alexander wrote a book on building a joint stool. A form is essentially a long joint stool. It's a bench. Let's see some of the other interesting ones here. And I'm reading through on Peter Follansbee's blog, because he put a nice summary on his blog of this ruling. So, and I'll put the link of that in the show notes in case you'd like to rule it or read it for yourself. But as you read through this, I think what you find is that's interesting is that if anything is joined with mortise and tenon, dovetailed, glue, and glued or pinned, it belongs to the joiners. The carpenters aren't allowed to do anything with mortise and tenon or dovetails or glue. That's all joiners' work. It's okay, though, if the carpenters use nails to build these items. And the carpenters, if you read up earlier, too, weren't allowed to use walnut. Walnut was joiners' wood. And deal, which is like a pine, and oak, and elm, and beech. Well, the carpenters can use that. You know, those were crappy woods. They could use that. So, but it's interesting because you now have these rules that are saying even though these carpenters can make these precision mortise and tenons and dovetails for these giant timber frames, they're not allowed to do that for furniture. That's the joiner's work. Carpenters, you guys can use nails. So all of this is kind of a very long-winded way of saying that nails have been used in furniture for a very long time. And this is what I'm talking about here is the 1630s. Nails have been used far longer than that. They go back to the Romans and even back to the ancient Egyptians. And nails can still be useful in furniture today. I've built plenty of nailed pieces, and I still build nailed pieces, and you know they're great for utility pieces and pieces that have to go together quickly and painted pieces. So I would say don't be afraid of using nails. Now, I know some of you are going to say, well, what about screws? Why wouldn't you just use screws instead of nails? Aren't screws going to hold better because of the threads? Well, let's talk for a second about the differences and the similarities between nails and screws. So both of them are going to require pilot holes, right? Unless you're using a nail gun or drawn wire nails, you're going to need to drill pilot holes for your nails as well as your screws, because if you don't, you're going to split your boards. Screws are going to require two different size pilot holes, though, because in order to properly use screws, the top board should be drilled as a through hole where the threads don't bite, and then the bottom board should be the only one that's drilled small enough that the threads will actually bite into it, and that's so that the screw will pull the two boards together. So that's a little bit slow and inconvenient to have to drill two different size pilot holes. Second, nails are malleable. They can bend, and that in turn is going to allow wood to move. We see a lot of period pieces where they have cross-grain construction. And the classic example is the six-board chest, where the front and the back of the chest, the grain runs horizontally, and the two sides of the chest, the grain runs vertically. And those pieces are joined together at the corners with those opposing grain directions. And the chests have survived for hundreds of years without self-destructing. And that's because of the nails. Those boards are expanding and contracting in different directions, but the nails are malleable enough that they allow that movement without causing the boards to split. In many cases, if you were to screw that joint together, the screws are not malleable. They're much more rigid, and they're not going to allow that movement. They're going to try to hold the wood in place, and what's going to happen? The wood is going to split right at that screw hole. So you're more likely to find splits when using screws. And then this next one, you know, this is really subjective. It's just my opinion, but I really think when you're using the right type of nails, they look way better than screws. There's no screw that can match the look of a nice wrought head nail, you know, in a chest or something like that. So I think nails really just look better than screws as well. So we're going to use nails in some different situations. You might need use them just to join the back of a case on. You know, let's say you're making a chest of drawers or something like that, and you've got a back that has to be attached to that chest of drawers. Nails are great for that. You know, you can use some wrought head nails or clout nails or even some fine finish nails, and they'll do a great job of holding that case back on. You could certainly use screws too. But again, if you're nailing on a solid back and not a plywood back, the nails are going to allow for that movement where the screws are not. But you need to use the right types of nails. I mentioned drawn wire nails before. They're very poor for furniture making. Drawn wire nails are straight, they're smooth, and because of that, they hold very weakly. It's very easy to take two boards apart that have been put together with drawn wire nails. And for that reason, most serious furniture makers that use nails in their work don't use drawn wire nails. Instead, we use cut or blacksmith-made wrought nails. They hold much stronger, and they look much better, and they're just preferred over the drawn wire nails. Now, if you're going to use nails, it's important to choose the right size. And nails are sold and identified by what is called a penny size. Now, if you're a carpenter, you already know all this, but if you're not familiar with it, I'll go through it, you know, rather briefly. Nails are sold by what's called a penny size. So when you buy a box of nails, you might see something on the box that says 4D or 6D. That D means penny. The number has to do with how long the nail is. So a two-penny nail starts at a two-penny nail. Two-penny nail is 1 inch, and it increases by a quarter inch per penny until you hit 10-penny. So a two-penny nail is 1 inch, a four-penny nail is 1.5 inches, a six-penny nail is 2 inches, all the way until you get to a 10-penny nail, which is 3 inches long. After 10-penny nails, you really start to get into carpentry nails and big framing nails, so I wouldn't worry about it. The numbering, it does change after 10-penny. It doesn't go up by quarter-inch increments anymore. Like a 12-penny nail is actually 3.5 inches, or 3, might even be longer than that. But anyway, it goes up by a larger increment when you get above 10-penny. But really, in our woodworking and furniture making, we're really not going to be getting into nails much bigger than 6-penny, maybe 8-penny on occasion. But, you know, 2 to 6-penny is really what we're going to be looking at. The rule of thumb, and Chris Schwarz published this some time ago, but I found it to be true as well, is that if you convert the top board thickness to 1/8 of an inch, that will tell you the size of the nail that you should be using. So let's say you're building a six board chest and the front board has, The front board is 3/4 inch thick, and the side board is 3/4 inch thick. And you're going to put that front board over the side board, and you're going to nail through that 3/4 inch board into the edge of the sideboard. So that board is 3/4 inch thick. If you convert 3/4 to 1/8, that's 6/8 inch. So you would use a 6-penny nail. So that 6-penny nail is about 2 inches, just a little bit over 2 times the thickness of that 3/4 inch top board at 2 inches long. And I found that's a good size. That seems to work well. You don't want to go just exactly twice as long as the top board because it doesn't seem to hold quite as well. But that little bit of extra length seems to give the extra hold that you really need. So again, if you convert the thickness of the top board to 1/8 inch, and just use the top number there. So 3/4 is 6/8. You use a 6-penny nail. That changes, of course, if you're going to cut rabbets in that front board. So if I'm going to cut a rabbet in that front board to sit over the sideboard, and that rabbet decreases the thickness to 3/8 inch, then I can use a slightly shorter nail, and it will do the same thing. So that's how you would kind of figure out, you know, what size nail is best to use for your situation. I personally keep 4 to 5 different types of nails on stock most of the time. So the first ones, and these are the ones I probably use the most, are fine finish nails. These are cut fine finish nails. And if you go to Tremont Nail, they make most of the world's supply of cut nails these days. Companies like Tools for Working Wood, and you know, they're repackaging Tremont nails essentially. So if you go to Tremont Nail, they have a huge selection of different nails, and you're not going to need them all. The first one that I keep on hand is fine finish nails, fine cut finish nails. They have a head, they are tapered along one side, and they are parallel along the other side. And there are 3 sizes that I primarily keep on hand. I keep 3-penny, 4-penny, and 6-penny nails on hand. And that really has to do just with the types of things that I use them for. You know, it might be nailing through the side of a case, you know, where there's a dado, or, you know, toenailing through a shelf that I set into a dado to kind of lock it in place, or building 6-board chests and things like that. I did an article several years ago for Popular Woodworking Magazine on building a chimney cupboard, completely nailed together piece. It used dados, rabbets, and nails for pretty much the entire case of that piece. And I think I used 6-penny nails for the majority of that. So 3, 4, and 6-penny nails, probably good sizes, good general sizes to use for furniture making in terms of finish nails. I also keep a good supply of wrought head nails, and these are cut nails, but they're meant to look like blacksmith forged nails. They have a faceted head, a large faceted head on them, and they're essentially decorative nails. I'll use them if I want to, you know, be very obvious that this piece was nailed together, and I want to show the nails, and I want it to look like, you know, a blacksmith made these nails, and that's what I'm using to nail this together. So I keep 4-penny and 6-penny wrought head nails on hand most of the time. The third kind of nails I typically keep on hand from Tremont are the headless cut brads. These are very, very, very fine cut nails that are typically used for attaching moldings and things of that nature. So I'll usually keep some 2-penny, some 3-penny, and some 4-penny cut brads on hand. What you're going to find is they're quite expensive because you get so many of them. I usually buy them by the quarter pound, not the pound, because, you know, a pound of, fine headless cut brads could run you $50. But you get an awful lot of nails in a pound. So I find that I tend to buy them in quarter pounds and keep a quarter pound of each size handy. And then when I start to get low on them, I'll buy another quarter pound, but 2, 3, and 4-penny in the headless cut brads is what I tend to keep around. I also keep some clinch nails around. Tremont sells them as rose head clinch nails, and they're, if you look at the head on them, they're not really a traditional shape nail. They're kind of a modern-looking, contemporary, decorative-type nail. You can one of the things you can do with them, though, is I've tried and been moderately successful, is to heat up the head with a torch and kind of pound it a little bit in a with a hammer on a vice anvil or a machinist vice to kind of give it a little bit more blacksmith-made, traditional look to the head. I've been somewhat successful doing that, but they're not perfect. But you could use them as is as well. They do come galvanized, which is not exactly the look that I'm after most of the time. So I will take that galvanized coating off, usually by either by soaking them in vinegar, white vinegar overnight, or you can just heat them up until with a torch until the zinc coating, the galvanized coating, burns off of them, and then you'll just get a nice steel nail. But I keep these around in an 8-penny size because they're good clinching nails. They're soft and malleable, and if you want to clinch the nails, like if you're doing a board and batten door and you want to drive the nails completely through the piece and then bend them over or clinch them over on the backside, they're great nails for that. And you need the longer length for clinching. So I keep the 8-penny nails around and the clinch nails. And that really seems to be about the only size that I need in those. And then I'll also use what we call trunnels or tree nails. Essentially, these are just wooden pegs. And I'll make these most of the time out of dry oak cutoffs that I have laying around. Firewood is probably the best for this because you just split off oak pieces and drive them through a dowel plate or just whittle them the size as you need them. I don't usually keep a lot on hand because I just typically make them as I need them. But sometimes I'll have some left over and I'll throw them in my nail box and have them there. So those are the types of nails that I tend to use the most. As for installing the nails, I mentioned before, you're going to want to bore a pilot hole. And I like to bore that pilot hole the full length of the nail. Some people will bore the pilot hole only, 2/3 to 3/4 the length of the nail and then let the nail just push its way through at the bottom. I've had some situations where with at least with some harder woods, I've run into problems doing that where the nail wouldn't drive fully and then the top bends over after the nail bottoms out. Or you could run the risk of splitting. So I tend to bore the pilot hole the full depth of the length of the nail. Then once you have that pilot hole drilled, and that's through both pieces, through the top board and through the board that you're nailing into, you're going to want to align the wedge shape of those nails with the grain of the top board. If you get the nail turned the wrong direction, that nail is going to act as a wedge pushing across the grain of that board, and it's going to split the board no matter whether you drill the pilot hole or not. So when using a cut nail, you want to make sure you align the wedge shape of the nail with the grain of the wood of the top board. The wedge shape isn't so pronounced at the bottom, so it really doesn't matter so much what grain direction the bottom board is going in. It's more important for the top board. So align the wedge with the grain of the top board. And then finally, don't try to drive the nail in the fewest blows possible. The old Nagelschlagen or Hammerschlagen game that we played at Woodworking in America and whatnot, where you're trying to be the first one to hammer your nail into the stump. That's not the game you're playing when you're nailing together furniture. I find that it's best to drive the nail gently. More blows is actually better. If you hit the nail too hard, like you're trying to drive a drawn wire framing nail into 2x4s, you're going to run the risk of bending the nail or splitting your timber, splitting your parts. So if you drive the nail slowly, you're much more likely to drive straight, and your timber will adjust gradually, and you're much less likely to split. In addition, cut nails sometimes have a tendency to twist as they're being driven in. So by driving them gently, you can watch for that twist as you're driving and hopefully either prevent it or correct it. If it starts to twist, you can either pull the nail out and, you know, turn the nail a little bit or use a different nail or grab it with a pair of pliers and try and prevent it from twisting and get it to bite so that it'll stop twisting, because you don't want it to twist out of that direction along the grain. Otherwise, you run the risk of splitting the wood. Making nailed furniture stronger or more rigid. So there are ways that we can do that. Now, you can certainly build a six-board chest and just nail the front to the sides and be done with it. And that chest will probably last your lifetime, maybe more. But there are ways that we can make nailed furniture a little bit stronger. And the primary way is to use some forms of simple joinery, like rabbets and dados. If you look at the chimney cupboard I built several years ago for Popular Woodworking, all the shelves, the interior shelves, they're fixed shelves, and they sit in dados, and then those shelves are nailed from the outside of the case. Similarly, the rabbets, the top sits in a rabbet, and it's nailed in from the outside of the case. If you build a six-board chest, you can rabbet the front and back board so that that shoulder of that rabbet gives the chest a little bit more rigidity, and you set the rabbet together and then drive your nails. And those simple forms of joinery don't require as much practice and as much skill to make as, say, a dovetail or a mortise and tenon, but they provide a great deal more strength and rigidity to the piece than just the nails alone. So just by adding a few rabbets or dados, you can really improve the strength and therefore the longevity of a piece of furniture that you've built with nails. So I always tend to use some type of dado or rabbet or groove when I'm building nailed pieces. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you can also clinch the nails on the backside of a piece if you're building something like a board and batten door. You drive the nail completely through the front boards as well as the back battens, and then bend them over and clinch them on the backside, and they act as staples to hold everything together. And that will be very strong and keep those nails from pulling out. And then the final question, of course, to fill or not to fill. Typically, I will not set my nails and below the surface and fill the holes unless I'm going to be painting with an oil-based paint, because most water-based paints and clear finishes just don't look good over wood filler, any kind of wood filler. It doesn't matter whether you make it yourself or buy it commercially. Water-based paints and wood fillers, just, you know, like milk paint and clear finishes, just don't look good over set nails. So if I'm using milk paint or I'm using a clear finish, I typically just leave the nails flush with the surface. Over time, they blend in and you don't see them anyway. If I'm using an oil-based paint, I will set the nails and fill with maybe a mixture of whiting and linseed oil, a chalk basically, and linseed oil makes a good filler. And then you can use your oil-based paint over top of that and you'll never see the nails. So it really depends on the situation. But most of the time, unless I'm using an oil-based paint or a paint that I've mixed up myself, like a, you know, from a varnish and a pigment, I'm usually not setting and filling those nail holes. So I hope you got something out of this and that you'll try using some of these techniques and using some nails. I think you'll find that nailed projects can be a lot of fun. They're really fast to put together and really functional. And they're just a lot of fun to build because you can get them done so quickly and they're so simple. And you don't have to fret over these mortise and tenon and dovetail joints. So, you know, they can be built inexpensively and quickly, and they're super functional and super fun. So I hope you'll try some of them. So that's going to do it for this week's show. As always, I want to thank you for joining me and for allowing me to do this, because without your support, none of this would be possible. As a reminder, please send in your feedback, questions, and topic suggestions, because the show depends upon your input and participation for its content. Just record a voice memo on your phone like Devin did for today's show and email it to bob@brfinewoodworking.com. You can also leave a voicemail at 276-601-3123, or you can use the contact form on the website at brfinewoodworking.com/contact. If you're looking for the show notes for today's episode, you can find them on my website at brfinewoodworking.com/htt018. And in the show notes, you can find any links that I referred to in today's show, and you can also find links to follow me on all of my social media accounts. Finally, if you'd like to support the show, you can become a supporter on Patreon, or you can make a one-time donation through PayPal. And you'll find links to do those things in the show notes and at brfinewoodworking.com/support. So thank you again for listening, and until next time, stay sharp, everybody.